Welcome. Welcome to Recipe for Peace Now. I'm your host, Sue Beller, and this is the show where we find practical, real-life solutions to difficulties bringing people together for a common goal, a common good. We will discuss listener emails, answer common questions, and at the end of the show, we will have a delicious, well, we'll actually have two delicious potluck recipes made for sharing with your new community of, well, if not exactly friends, at least willing participants. If you would like to send in a question or a favorite recipe, please email us at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com or visit our website, www.recipeforpeacenow.com. Also, I know that a lot of you are returning listeners. Thank you very much. It's always lovely to have you. And we have a lot of new people coming in, too. If you would like to hear a prior show, the last five are archived on the website, recipeforpeacenow.com. And all the shows, including the last five, are archived at the radio station at www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. Thanks. Now let's get started. Now today our topic is going to be creative thinking. Now I know we talk about that a lot on these shows, and everything we do, right, is really creative thinking when we're hosting a gathering, when we're hosting a community, when we're trying to find consensus. But I know that a lot of you say, and this is true, I get this in emails all the time, people say, I say, it depends a lot when people ask questions, and that's where the creative part comes in, right? Because it does depend on the circumstances. And we've talked about all kinds of circumstances in these shows, but really what we're thinking about today, thinking about during this show, is how to really think during the process to, well, you know, there's an American expression, and I know this is a global show, but I imagine everybody has the equivalent, to think on your feet, to think while you're sitting there is what it really means, to think while you are, to analyze the situation and to be able to come up with a solution on the moment, as you're sitting there, as you're doing the hosting, as you're doing the whatever it is you're doing, a seminar, a talk, a workshop, to be able to think on your feet. You see, I know it's a colloquialism, but we all understand what it means. Yes, oh, thank you for your participation. I'm getting a lot of yeses. Yes, we know what it means. Go on. Yes, it's excellent. So, as a practical matter, how are we going to do this? How do we think on our feet? How do we assess the situation at the moment and not only keep it from getting out of hand, but keep it focused, keep the participants focused and moving forward towards the common goal, moving forward towards success, towards what it is that we've decided that we're going to do? And you know how people say sometimes a group derails, it doesn't get anywhere? Well, we don't have that kind now, do we? Because we are the host, we are the facilitator, and we are going to move it forward. And I've got a lot of participation already. Thank you very much for all of your participation. I love having you. You know what? Jennifer has made a very good point, and several other people have made it too. Thank you. They're saying that if you look around, you look at the body language of the people who are participating, at the body language, at how they are moving, how they are sitting. You know, several people have agreed with this, and I have several people who are saying, and then Bruce and Jennifer and like that, thank you very much for your participation. Several people are saying that many times the body language becomes defensive body language. Now let's think about that. What does that look like? Yes, this is true. People cross their arms, for example, or lean back away from the group. They distance themselves. People do this unconsciously. Body language is oftentimes an unconscious activity, and it tells you something about who is disengaging from the group who disagrees. A lot of times you see people who are listening to someone discussion issue, and they kind of make a face and they rear back in their chair and squint. You know what I mean? They kind of make a, oh, I don't think so, defensive body language motion. And, you know, a very good point is being made. Yes, they're saying that a lot of people are saying that the thank you, Aaron and Jim and Soji and Bruce. The comment is being made that not only does the individual have body language that we can look at, and oftentimes it's not as obvious, but, you know, people roll their eyes, right? I've had people saying rolling eyes and shifting up and back, playing with something like something in their pocket or something in their hand. I don't know if I'm supposed to say this on the radio or not, but you've got people that are like picking their teeth or running their hand through their hair, doing something that is distancing themselves from the group or showing some disapproval or maybe approval, right? Body language goes both ways. People, if they are interested and involved and you've got the group is really going forward, people will, what will they do? Yes. They will lean forward instead of back, right? They will look more attentive instead of shifting around or running their hand through their hair or something. They will look more attentive. They will look directly at the speaker, for example, and really engage with them. Yes. So body language goes both ways, right? It's not all a defensive, I don't want to be here motion. It could be a, wow, I'm really engaged. I'm really interested. Let's keep going forward. And then, you know, not to have a timeout, right? You're making progress. You're going forward. You need to continue the momentum, right? Yes. Oh, but anyways, people are making a very good point that a lot of times the thing to look for is not just the individual body language, but people looking to others in the group for validation. You see, they look around and they make yeah with somebody else in the group. And that's always an interesting thing to watch for because it tells you who the groups are, who the agreements, where the issue agreement is, and where the issue disagreement is, and who is, well, I don't like to say taking sides. People are saying who is taking sides is what they find out. I guess it kind of is. It's who is in agreement with each other. We'll call it that. Because taking sides has a negative connotation. And quite frankly, sometimes it's a good thing. That's the way you make subcommittees. You say, well, would you like to work with this person to research this idea and bring it back to the group, you see? And you already know from the body language in the room that these people are from their discussions and from their agreements, that these people will work well together, that they will take their duty seriously and will come back with an interesting research for the group, an interesting issue research. So, yes, body language is a wonderful way to, something to look for so that we can assess the situation and be creative and be thoughtful and inspired to keep it going forward, to keep the group involved. Because if you see that you're losing them, you know that you're going to shift slightly, call a time out. That's really what Recipe for Peace Now's food context is for, isn't it? It's not because we're hungry. It's because it makes a good shift, a good time out, a good distraction. So, and also people are saying not only body language, but you need to listen to the wording to determine the people's state of mind. Aaron says that the tone of voice is very important. And I think that's a very good point. I'm getting a lot of agreement here. Yes, You listen, you look not only to how the people are reacting, but you also listen to their words, listen to the tone of voice, listen to how excited they are, listen to how, well, not very, very consensus-making they are. You know, they might, their tone of voice might be condescending, now couldn't it? Or even, dare I say it, yes, people are saying oftentimes it's rude. Yes, it could be borderline offensive. We've talked about people who are in our groups who get up and try to dismantle the group by having, by creating a fight, by creating dissension. And, you know, that's the tone of voice and the body language will tell you that before it gets too far is the key to it. Yes. And, now, this is an interesting comment, and I think it's a very valid one. Aaron says that sometimes body language is deliberate. You know, we always think of body language as something that is unconscious, right? You know, we're told to look for it because it's an unconscious act, and you know, the shifting of the eyes. And there are books written about it. You can look it up on the internet, how it works, and the different movements that happen. And Aaron makes an interesting point that because everyone knows about body language, and it's not a really well-kept secret, and you can, just like I said, look it up on the internet, that sometimes people deliberately use body language to give off cues deliberately. Now, I don't know that that's something to know too. And they are telling you something about lack of focus, about much focus. You know, it is something to watch for. Yes, I think sometimes tone of voice is often deliberate and body language is often deliberate too. You know, writers write about it in the articles and the different, you know, psychology magazines write about body language and tone of voice, and they seem to indicate that people are doing it unconsciously. But it's a very good point that lots of times that is a conscious act, and it is a signal to the host and to the others in the room about the way the group is going and the way and whether or not we are still on focus and on task. So even if it's deliberate, it's a real good indication. In fact, maybe even a better one if it's deliberate. And, you know, Marianne is making an interesting point here also, just like the deliberate body language. She's making an interesting point that we're talking about wording, like how people choose their words and whether or not the words are positive or negative in connotation, and whether or not the tone of the voice is so also, whether or not you've got perhaps sarcasm or perhaps enthusiasm, you see. And she's making a very good point that if you have repetition in the say of the same exact phrases, it may indicate that it is not the person's own thought, but was memorized. And I see I've got some agreement with this, and some people have experienced this. And yes, I've seen that too. Now, I must confess that I've seen it several times with people who are stating an issue but are not comfortable speaking in front of other people. So they have indeed memorized, like, catchphrases. They've memorized key phrases that they want to be sure and put in. I've seen people get up with index cards and with pads of paper when they are making a point. You know, they've got notes. So if you've got someone with notes, that's just probably because they are not, they're somewhat nervous speaking before a group. Some people are. And I've got quite a bit of agreement that people do that. You guys do it somewhat too, I see, that especially when you're, if the host is going to make an opening statement, sometimes people use some sort of notes or whatever. Not everyone is comfortable speaking before a group, and they want to be certain that they don't miss anything. But I think that, but Mariana tells me that that's not what she was thinking about, that she's seen where someone has given one of the participants or several participants put an idea in their head that they're parroting. and it's they haven't thought it through. And that's an interesting thing to think about, too. If your participants are, if at least, well, not all of them, of course, but you know, I once saw this, where more than one participant was repeating the same kind of stilted phrase when dealing with an issue. It was a phrase about morals. It was one of those, well, the issue was kind of tender, but it was one of those moralistic type phrases. And if you see someone's doing that, and I know I'm going to say it again, it depends. But if you've got that, that's what creative thinking, thinking on your feet is. If you see you've got that, you can ask them where the phrase comes from, maybe. That's what I did. I said, well, where's that phrase come from? Where did you get that? Is that, could you explain it to us, what it means? It was one of those, you know, sentences that I knew hadn't come from the mouth of the person that was saying it. And sure enough, it hadn't. It had been kind of enthused, kind of put there by an outside party with a particular interest in the outcome that was not necessarily to the benefit of consensus. Can I say that? That was a polite way of saying it was really not a good thing. And I see I've got a lot of agreement here that sometimes that happens. And we have, pardon me, and quite a few people are saying that that sometimes happens when you have cultural or religious issues and somebody is doing some sort of a quotation that they have heard. I wasn't really thinking of it in a quotation. Pardon me, like a quotation, like a quote from the Bible or something. It's more like someone saying something by rote, R-O-T-E, by rote, something that they have memorized and is not, and they haven't thought it through either. I'm in favor of saying, could you tell me what that means, please? Always polite, of course, because you've got words for your tone of voice too, right? Right. Just like you're watching everybody else's body language and tone, what are they doing? Yes, they are watching you. And so you always have to be polite and keep your tone even and calm. But yes, it's a very interesting point that sometimes the thoughts you are hearing are not the personal thoughts of the person saying them. They are mouthing something that someone else said. And you need to look for that. You need to think about it. And you need to think about what to do. It depends. It depends on the situation, doesn't it? And, you know, Edward's making a point that you look, as several other people have said this basically, that you look to the groupings in the room to see who the allies and dissenters are. You look to the groupings. You look to see who is, well, who's sitting with each other, so to speak, and who is agreeing and who's nodding at each other and who's making eye contact and like that, so that you see who it is. If you've got consensus, or you've got little groups that are disagreeing with each other and need to be brought together. And, you know, this is a very valid point. A lot of people are saying that creative thinking really is attention to details. And that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Attention to details with the people in the room. You know, Sozi says that sometimes you can feel a shift in the mood in the room. You could feel that the people are getting, well, for example, tired, right? Or divisive. Or they're getting hungry. I mean, you know, you could feel the shift in the mood. And you know, I've got quite a bit of agreement with that. And people are saying that you can have a shift in focus. You've kind of trailed off into a different area, and you're not focused on what we were talking about, focused on the discussion, focused on the issues. And yes, and Hansen says you can have a shift in the discussion path. That happens. Sometimes it kind of happens within the conversation, and you need to get the focus back to the issues and not let the discussion kind of go into nothingness, go kind of just meander and not get anywhere. And, you know, it's a good point that Hansen says that the timing of the shifts, it makes a difference, because when it may be reasonable when you have not changed position but are going on to the next one. And you know, and it is true that if you have a shift in the discussion, it could be natural. It could be something that just is kind of happening as the issues evolve, as the questions evolve and the answers evolve. You see? So there's a certain evolution to these things, but they may also be an indication of outside influence. And a lot of you are saying that's when you have a shift, you know, this is a very good point. It depends on the timing of the shift, and I see what you meant, yes. Ian has clarified, and several others have helped clarify. The timing of the shift in the mood is important, the timing of the shift in the focus. It depends if it's happening naturally and evolving as we discuss, or we came to consensus, we ended the meeting, and when we came back, consensus had dissolved and there was a shift. You see the difference? Sometimes things shift because it is natural and we are getting a better sense of what needs to be done. And sometimes things shift outside the community, outside the meeting, outside the workshop, the seminar, whatever it is that you're doing. And people come back in and they've changed their mind. They've no longer, the consensus is no longer there. You've got a shift in mood and a shift in people's attitude. Now, that is a sign of outside influence, isn't it? Yes, we've all agreed that something has happened on the outside that has caused the shift. What do we need to do? How can we be creative and get this back? You know, some people are saying that you can outright ask, and I'm rather in favor of getting things out in the open. You know, that's a good point. You can point it out and ask if there's been communication outside the room and if we'd like to share. Sometimes you find out that someone else needs to be invited into the process, don't you? And I see that a lot of you have had that experience. There's been a shift because some outsider has influenced the process, and they need to no longer be an outsider. They need to be invited in. So, now, Padme and others have talked about improvisation as the issues unfold. And that's really what we're thinking about, isn't it? It's improvisation. And it's more creative. Being creative, creative thinking is more of an attitude than it is an actual rule. You know, I always say that we have no rules about how to handle something. It depends. You need to be creative as you are there. And whatever works is good. There's no rules. There's no hard and fast rules. And improvisation, yes, Padme, it's really what we're talking about. And that's why it's really important not to script the process, not to have a real set guideline, a real set way that it must go, right? Because that will keep us from being creative. And the trick really is, you know, several people are using this word, and it's really true. It's not just improvisation, because, of course, we need to be prepared, right? We need to have done the research for the issues. We need to have thought about it. But it's really negotiation tactics. And a lot of people are saying that the main thing is that as the leader, we need to remain calm. We need to keep the process on an even keel and to be calm. And that creative, Sasha makes an interesting point that creative thinking is looking for a new way to approach old issues. And Edward says that you look at the issues from a new perspective. You know, that's a really good point. That's what makes it creative. You can't script it and come in and say, well, I know how this is going to go, because you don't. And I've got a whole bunch of experience, and I'm telling you, I never do. I've got an idea. I've got a notion of how things are going to go, and I have done my homework, and I know the issues and the various areas that need to be worked on. But, you know, you can always shift perspective, and that everyone in the group needs to participate in that. In fact, this is an interesting point. Janice and others are saying that one of the ways that they do creative thinking, and I am very fond of this. I know that some of you have been to my seminars and workshops, and like that, and thank you, by the way. And you're mentioning that I do this all the time, and I do sometimes, depending on the group, usually doing a workshop. Not so much during a mediation, but some, it depends. I've said it depends again. But it depends on the issues and on the people involved and whether it's appropriate. That's where the creative comes in. But Janice and others have said that it is valuable to role play, where you take the opposite side in a creative and practical way so that you gain a new perspective because you're someone else in the group. Someone else on a different side of the issues, so that you can really think about them, because you have to argue them. You become a different person within the process. You role play. And it is that really encourages creative thinking by everyone. See, and a lot of you are making this point, Donald and Heinrich and others, that creative thinking is not the purview of just the host, right? Creative thinking is something that everybody needs to engage in, because we're engaging with each other. It's an up-and-back discussion process, a mediation, a negotiation, and not performance art where only the host is speaking and there's replies. It's a give and take, an up-and-back. That's why role-playing, even if the role-playing is not formal. You see, a lot of you are thinking about formal role play. You will be this person, and we will do role playing in the room, and we'll all take a different side. That is a valuable exercise, but sometimes role playing is not stated so definitely. But that's the shift in perspective, where you can see someone else's side and go, wait a minute, that's a valid point, and I hadn't thought about it before. And, you know, that's creative thinking by everyone, and it needs to be encouraged. And, you know, Heinrich says that you play, that if instead of literal role-playing, and this is, actual role-playing is only appropriate in certain circumstances, right? Usually a more of a workshop education type circumstance. I have taught classes where we have role played so that we can all see the different sides to an issue. It's only appropriate in certain circumstances and when you have the right group and enough time. But Heinrich is mentioning that really what you're really doing when you are not formally role-playing is that you're playing the what-if game, right? That whenever you have an exercise with direct participant involvement, that you can play the what-if game. What if this were so? You see, that changes perspective. It changes the way you have to think about it, and that makes everyone think, because the reason that, yes, I have quite a bit of dissension about the role-playing idea. And this is a very good point, and this is why it's role-playing is only used under certain circumstances where it's appropriate, because role-playing can become offensive to someone. It's like you're mocking them. And that's why, yes, I have a great deal of dissension. People are saying they would never have role-playing in a community setting in order to get consensus because that is like mocking someone. And that's a good point. And that's why we do the what if. What if this occurred? And then we all have to think about it and shift perspective somewhat. And it's a good way to get people involved again. When you see that you've got quite a few people whose body language or whatever, and you see that you're losing focus, the what if exercise is interesting. And you don't have to say it's an exercise. You just throw it out there. What if? And then you say something that could happen in real life. And as a practical point, what if this happened? And we all have to think, oh, my. Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, a lot of you are saying that you do several practical things. Oh, I just love this. I always learn something when I do this show. And I hope you do, too. And a lot of you are saying that you do something very practical that I have not actually done because I haven't had the right group, the right set of issues for it, I think. But this is a really interesting thought. Michael and Jennifer and Dale and other people say that they actually have, in order to have creative thinking on the issues, they bring in outside thoughts, like from the community, and they do this in a competition. What an interesting thought, especially if your issue lends itself to that. Perhaps some. I got to think about what. Why did you use this as a competition? What issues were there? Most of the people, let's see, you've used the competition when they want to change a law, for example, or regulation. Not change it, I see, for getting safety regulations and things. You want to create a change in the law that has to do with a specific safety regulation or a health regulation or a school rule or something like that. That's interesting. Yes, it has to be very specific and it has to be capable of being thought about by the community in a creative manner. So that you have a competition for creative problem solving that you've opened to community members. And Michael says that he used it as a school class project. And Dale says, yes, an MBA project. And you can use it as a dissertation for a doctorate. You see, you get an outside opinion, and then you look at them and see which one is practical and viable. And Christopher says that he uses internships for class credits and experience. And with the internet, you can have global openings and Skype, and this is true. And we, Recipe for Peace Now, has global representatives all over, and all kinds of people are using Skype and getting together. And yes, you of course, you don't have to literally sit in the same room. That's very interesting, a competition. And how are competitions judged, though? We've got the ones that are classes and things are judged by a panel that involves the school and the organizations involved. That's really interesting, a competition. And the prize is, of course, that your idea gets to be practical, gets to be put into being. And, Marilyn says that they not only have a competition for outside civic or projects, have a competition for practical ideas, but they hold a fundraiser and they actually give a scholarship, a small scholarship for, not a full one, but a small scholarship for being the prize winner. That's when you do it for schools, when you do it in classes. How interesting. My goodness. And John says that you can have research teams for what others have done in similar situations. That's a great idea, too. We do that all the time. There's no sense in reinventing the wheel, right? You can have research teams, especially the internet, it makes it easy and wonderful. And you can see what other people in similar situations have done. Look, they've done it for you. But I'm really taken by the competition idea. That's wonderful. Thank you very much for your participation and for telling us all about that. A competition for like civil projects to get the most creative and practical idea. I bet that's wonderful in schools, and people get experience, and experience speaking, experience thinking. What a good idea. And Andy says that you can use social media campaigns to influence lawmakers. Well, as long as we're in the civic field, in the regulation and law field, yes, I social media is wonderful for that. And, of course, we're going to do it in a polite and non-threatening, non-violent, non-obnoxious way. But, yes, of course. And Sam says you not only influence lawmakers, you influence public opinion like that. You know, quite a few of you are saying that you have raised money for scholarship prize for the best practical idea and implementation, says Kevin. Best practical idea and implementation. I like it. to actually get all kinds of outside creative thinking going. And then, of course, we're going to discuss it all, and maybe even some of you have had public forums for the discussion. How interesting. Yes. I think that's wonderful. And we've got a lot of people saying that the idea is to do the networking and to keep the connections open so that you can go forward and have what Recipe for Peace Now always says, have a convivial atmosphere and an open one so that we can all think creatively. What a wonderful idea to get everyone, it's not just the job of the host to be a creative thinker and to keep the process going. We're all involved, right? Everybody's involved. And that's the whole idea of the thing, to keep it going and to keep the network and connections open for the next time so that we can all have a relationship already. And we know who to talk to, who to get together with. Yes, that's one of the ideas of creating the convivial atmosphere, isn't it? And yes, I see people going, have you gotten to the recipe section? Yes, I have. We are on to the recipe. Thank you for all of your participation. Those were really interesting comments and interesting ideas on how to be creative. Thank you very much. That was wonderful. And In the interest of networking, right, because Recipe for Peace Now always says that one of the ways to get people to come into the room and have consensus and a good time out sometimes and a way to shift focus is to have a potluck, essentially speaking, to have some food involved. And yes, you all know, those of you who are returners, thank you very much for coming back. I always love having you. And for those of you who are new, but I need to say it because it's so important. Before we get to the recipe portion of this show, I'm going to say that when you're going to have people bring food, or even if it is catered, or in some way have food for the group, you need to label it. Label it. Not only what it is, but what is in it. All the ingredients need to be told. And you tell your people beforehand, by email, by phone, by however you're communicating, that they need to put down all the ingredients for whatever it is that they're bringing. Because people have religious prohibitions, they have dietary prohibitions, and they have allergies. And when you're emailing and calling, you will ask people if they have one of these things, if they have a religious prohibition, a dietary prohibition, or an allergy to something. And this will be respected. And you will tell everybody that someone is allergic to fill in the blank, peanuts, whatever on earth it is, and ask them not to bring a dish containing that ingredient. And it's very important that they label everything, because this is a convivial atmosphere, and you do not want someone to get sick or offended or have a bad time in any way. So everything needs to be labeled. And you all know that I think that you as the host, that we as the hosts, need to have some extra food so that in case someone doesn't bring enough. And I'm truly an advocate of having, and also our stuff must be labeled, right, very carefully. And I'm an advocate of having what I call a safe dish in addition to a more adventure dish. Now, what makes something a safe dish? I think that the rule is that it has ingredients that most people know, they're familiar with, and there's no real surprises to it, because sometimes people don't read the list very carefully. So I think that a safe dish is something that doesn't have too tremendous amount of ingredients, and everybody's familiar with them, and most people are not allergic to them, or have dietary prohibitions, or have religious prohibitions. But you never know. That's why you got to ask, and that's why you got to label. So let's get on to our safe recipe for this evening. And that I'm going to be, is this evening is going to be a traditional bread pudding. And yes, you can use older bread or some sort of bread that is dense and not, it cannot be tremendously fresh. But please, 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 please do not cook with something that is garbage. If it should be thrown out, you should throw it out. And not if it's got mold or something, and not try to put it into a recipe, please. Okay, now with that warning, I tell you that. Yes, hello. Okay, so first we're going to have 2 big pats of butter, 2 ounces of butter. And we're going to have 10 thick slices of a dense bread, or a bread that is slightly stale. If it's really mushy bread, if it's really soft, it kind of airy, it will not make a nice bread pudding. It needs to be kind of a dense bread. In this area, in the United States, you can get thick sliced bread. Or you can, of course, get a bread that's not sliced and slice it yourself. But I rather like a thick slice. And we're going to have 1/2 cup of raisins. And we're going to have 4 tablespoons of sugar. If you can, I do like the super fine because it mixes better. And if otherwise you get kind of, the sugar's a little bit too granulated. So if you can get a hold of it, it's super fine is better. Okay, and then we're going to have 1 teaspoon of cinnamon. Ground cinnamon? The cinnamon looks like a powder. I think it's ground cinnamon. 1 teaspoon of cinnamon. 3 eggs that we're going to beat. 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract. And 3 cups of milk, whole milk, please, and 3/4 cup of heavy cream. So we've got the butter, the bread, the raisins, the superfine sugar, the cinnamon, the 3 eggs that have been beaten, 2 teaspoons of vanilla extract, the 3 cups of milk, and the 3/4 cup of heavy cream. So we're going to preheat our oven to 350, and then we're going to grease a rectangular pan. It doesn't have to be too deep. About a 22 by 18, whatever the 10 slices of bread will fit in, it kind of an overlap pattern. We don't want it to all be, they need to overlap each other, otherwise the pudding will have holes. And so we're going to grease that, and then we're going to butter the bread themselves. In all truth and honesty, I like to melt the butter and just brush it on with a brush, but you can do as you please, and you can certainly use a knife, but you need to, the butter has to be fairly soft. So we're going to butter the bread, and then we're going to cut it in half in points, and we're going to arrange it so that they're touching each other in rows, in a couple of rows in the pan, so that they're one against another. They're going to layer them. And then we're going to sprinkle the raisins and the sugar and the cinnamon all over them. I'm going to combine them, sprinkle that all over. In fact, I must confess, I like to sprinkle in between the layers too. Otherwise, it's not as tasty. And then we're going to take the eggs, the vanilla, the milk, and the cream, and we're going to whisk them all together. And we're going to pour the liquid mixture over the bread. And then we're going to let it stand for about half an hour, 45 minutes would be even better, because we want, until the bread has soaked up all the liquid so that it's nice and moist. And we're going to bake this whole thing for about 40 minutes, maybe 45. We're going to bake it until the whole thing is set. You can look at it, and you know the egg and the milk and the sugar have created like a custard around it. And you can look at it and see that it's set, that the custard has set. And you know that I truly think all of these things, after you make them and you take them out, if you let it stand right just on the counter on a hot plate board, if you let it stand for about 5-10 minutes, it will set even better before you cut it, before you serve it. It's also extremely hot, so it's not going to do any harm to let it sit for a few seconds, few minutes. But anyway, so that is a traditional bread pudding. Has very few ingredients. Hardly anybody is allergic to it. And it's yummy. You serve it with a big spoon and people take as much as they want. And most people really like it. It's the kind of a thing that everybody, every kind of group has one of those in their cooking repertoire, because quite frankly, most cultures, most types of food, somewhere along the line you have day-old bread. And we've all figured out how to make a delicious pudding out of that. And so that is the safe recipe. And it is safe because it's easily labeled and it doesn't have too much to be allergic to or have a dietary prohibition. Now, I actually have quite a few people that have emailed me and asked for a seafood recipe. And I have here a curried shrimp stir fry. I don't oftentimes, this is my adventure recipe, I don't oftentimes serve shrimp unless I am very certain that everybody is not allergic to it and does not have a religious prohibition. Shrimp is like pork. Shellfish is like pork. A lot of people have a religious prohibition, and a lot of people are allergic to either shrimp to either shellfish or fish. So one must be careful. If you have someone who is allergic or you just don't want to serve shrimp, it is easily substituted with chicken. You will, of course, cook the chicken through first, right? Right. You'll put it in the oil first, and you will cook it on all sides until it turns brown. You will take it out of the pot and set it aside and do the whole thing like I'm doing with the shrimp and then put it back in. So this is easily substituted with chicken. Truth be told, I always use chicken. I never bring shrimp. It just seems to me that there's so many allergies and prohibitions against shellfish that I never bring it. And you know that I'm in the United States, and in my area, of course, I must confess that chicken's a lot cheaper than shrimp. So that's the other thing. But people have asked me for a seafood recipe, because I never give one, and this is true, because I don't usually bring it. You don't want this to be seafood, make it chicken. Okay, now that I've said that, we're going to have a pound of shrimp. Out here, they're frozen and cooked, pre-cooked, very easy to get. So I'm going to say the frozen, pre-cooked kind. We are going to thaw that, and we are going to drain off all the liquid and give them a nice pat down with a paper towel. We're going to dry them off. Okay, so we've got about a pound of those little shrimps. And we've got about 2 tablespoons, make it 3 tablespoons of oil, a minced onion, 2 teaspoons of curry powder, a cup of, all right, I'm going to use frozen peas because it's easy for me to get that. If you want to use fresh peas, go. But let's say a cup of frozen peas, and I'm going to say 1/2 cup of frozen corn. We're going to thaw those two, of course, and give them a pat so they're not wet. You want to use fresh. Yours will probably come out better than mine. But I tend to use the frozen because it is easily available to me, and it makes it a lot faster and less expensive to bring as a potluck meal. And we're going to have a large zucchini that we're going to slice nice and thin, and a nice big red bell pepper that we're going to core and seed and rough dice, a teaspoon of coriander seeds that we're going to crush, a little bit of salt, and a tablespoon of lemon juice, just because it goes nice with the shrimp. If you're using chicken, you might think about the lemon juice and leave it off. Okay, so we've already thawed the shrimp and drained them and patted them down, right? So we're going to heat the oil and with the onion and the curry, and we're going to put it in a big frying pan, and we're going to stir it around and do it until the onion is soft and it smells delicious, and that takes, what, about 5 minutes. After we're going to, and then we're going to take the prawns, and then we're going to add them to the onion and curry and oil in the pan. And we're going to stir fry them until all the liquid has evaporated out. Then we're going to add the peas, the corn, the zucchini, the red bell pepper, and we're going to stir fry that for about 5 minutes until everything is heated through and it looks really nice and it starts to smell wonderful. And then we're going to add the crushed coriander seeds and a little bit of salt and a little bit of lemon juice just to brighten up the seafood. Now, that was easy, wasn't it? So why is that my adventure recipe? Well, it's got something that people are oftentimes allergic to. It's got shrimp. We could get rid of that with the chicken. But it's got several things that are not as usual and are not as obvious. It's got curry powder. It's got coriander. And you never know. Someone might be allergic to that. So it has to all be done and labeled. But this is fast, this is easy, and the other thing that I love about stir fries is that if you have the facilities, they are a wonderful group project for the networking, for the getting together, for doing something together that comes out right. You put in the shrimp or the chicken, you have the oil. You have the curry and the onion. You put in the protein. You put in the vegetables. You put in the spices. And voila. In about 15 minutes, less, more like 12, you've got a lovely dish that is delicious. Everyone has participated or watched. And it is easy to make. And it smells delightful. And we can do it as a group. So I think stir fries are wonderful for group participation. And, of course, with this, you will, of course, make a giant bowl of rice, right, so that everyone can partake of it. And if you have a rice steamer, that's always one of those specialty pots. I actually have one because I make rice so much and bring it. One of those electric steamers, you can just bring it right in that. And the rice goes with it, and you put in a big side pot so everyone can take as much rice as they want. And it is fast and easy. Everyone can do it. Everyone can watch. And it gives you something to do as a timeout, right? Right. I think stir fries are wonderful for that. And, of course, you can do some of the prep work ahead of time. But this one really doesn't have too much prep work. And, yes, of course, you can make substitutions of the protein. People are asking about it. You know, I always say whatever it is that you are using as your protein, as your either the shrimp or the chicken or whatever it is that you like to use, just remember that whatever it is that it needs to be cooked thoroughly through. And you judge your item. You know, a lot of people, in the United States, we use chicken a lot. And people ask me about rabbit and goat and other things. And the answer is, of course, it's just that where I am, that would be a rather expensive, unusual thing to get in the grocery store. So I usually say chicken because it's easy. And it's available and most people can eat it. But whatever it is that you like to cook with, of course, cook with it and enjoy it. Have a nice time, and stir fries are good for doing it together. So, we are out of time today. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you come again. I always learn something on these shows. Thank you very much for teaching me something. I hope we all learn something together. Thank you very much. If you would like to send in a question or a recipe or a comment, we're at recipeforpeacenow@gmail.com. The website is www.recipeforpeacenow.com. The last five shows are archived on the website. All of the shows, including the last five, which includes this, of course, are archived on the radio station, which is www.blogtalkradio.com/recipeforpeacenow. And thank you very much for coming. I hope you come again. Thanks. Bye-bye.